Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm so excited to have you here and welcome.
Thank you, Chrissy.
Well, first off, I want to let you know that I've actually turned to What Color Is Your Parachute for many years at several different times in my career, and I refer my clients to it all the time. So thank you for creating this just amazing, rich resource, and congratulations on the 40th edition.
Yes, thank you.
So we all are really familiar with this work. We've been reading it for years, but I'd love it if you would kind of take me back to, I guess, 1972 and tell me a little bit about
Earlier
what
than that,
really?
1970, December 1st.
1970. Oh my gosh. So what inspired you that first time to write the very first edition?
Well, you have various experiences in life that when you look back, you say, oh, that was valuable because it made me more sensitive to something I wouldn't have been noticing much otherwise. And in my case, that was that I was on the staff of, I was an ordained Episcopal minister, and I was on the staff of Grace Cathedral. In fact, I was the canon pastor there. And they had a budget crunch, and they let me go. So I cast about for another job, and I found one. And it involved supervising in a very loose sort of way anybody from the Episcopal Church who was on campuses in the nine western states, who was doing what was called campus ministry, either to the students or the faculty or the administration or all three. And I, at the same time, was representing nine other denominations because the Episcopal Church had just joined an entity called United Ministries in Higher Education. So when I went on campuses, I noticed that after I was doing this for about a year, I was talking to men who were campus ministers and facing the same problem that I had. In other words, they all knew my history. They all knew where you were let go because of a budget crunch. Tell us what we should do. And I said, I haven't got the foggiest notion. And so they said, well, what kind of help can we look for? And I said, I'm going to go find it for you myself. I have a handsome travel budget. I'm going to travel around the country, and I'm going to try to find the answer. They had two questions, always. Well, the first question was, how do I find a job if resumes, ads, and agencies don't work? What's plan B? And the other question they all had on their minds was, how can I choose a new career if I choose not to go back into the institutional church and be a parish minister? How do I go about preparing for another career without having to go back to school for 4 years? And so I kept a log. I traveled 68,000 miles, and I got the answers to those questions finally from some people who actually had some good ideas. And I put them together. I typed the book myself. It was in the pre-computer days. And I took it down to a local copy shop, and I said, would you please put this together and put some kind of a binding on it? And they did. And I sent it out to the campus ministers who were in the nine western states, my territory. And suddenly I noticed I was getting orders from everybody. I was getting orders from General Electric, from the Pentagon, from the State Department, from UCLA. And I said, look, I wrote this book for campus ministers. And they said, we know that, but it's so helpful. We can translate it into the language of our own systems and our own target populations. And so a commercial publisher appeared, and he said, really, I would love to publish this book. And that's how it took off. 1972, it began its career as a commercial book when the previous 2 years had been self-published.
Wow, that is amazing. As a writer, I'm incredibly inspired by your story.
In other
Wow.
words, Chrissy, I stumbled into it.
Yeah, that's
I
great.
didn't
And
intend to try to be a best-selling author or anything. I just was trying to help some people. In fact, I had friends of mine, and they would be talking to someone they knew, and they'd say, "I want to be a success like Bowles. I want to write a book, and I want it to be very popular, and I want to make a lot of money, and so on." And this friend of mine, his name was Bill Holm, and he would always say, "That's not the point." He wrote it to help people, not to make money. If you can get that same mind frame, maybe you'll be blessed too, but don't go directly trying to make money because that wasn't his intent and it shouldn't be yours.
Right. That there's such a big lesson in there, and it's very, you know, relatable, I think, for everyone. Like, part of the importance of the book is, you know, finding your mission in life and what you're really meant to do and using your skills to the highest power. So do you feel like you've really kind of stumbled into your own life mission here?
Oh, absolutely. No question about that. I'm 84 years old now. I've been doing this for 40 years. We didn't mention the fact that I revise the book every year. In fact, that was a condition of my signing the contract. I said, I'll sign. This was when the commercial publisher appeared. His name was Phil Wood, and he ran a little press called 10-Speed Press because he had a big success with a book called Anybody's Bike Book by Tom Cuthbertson. And so he called his whole press 10-Speed Press in honor of his one big bestseller at that time. And so I said, I'll sign the contract provided that as soon as it's economically sensible, makes sense economically, I want you to revise this book. I want you to publish a revised copy of this book every year. And we missed 1 year, but otherwise, ever since then, and including this year, I've actually rewritten the book each year. And people, for the current edition, which came out in August, it's called the 2012 edition. It's the 40th edition, as you hinted. And people have said this edition this year is so different from the one last year or any earlier ones because with the crisis we're in now in terms of our economy and our jobless recovery, I knew I had to rewrite the entire book to say something true and new, which is that job hunting has become a survival skill. And if you want to either find work or change careers now, it's become essential that you be the manager of your own career or your own job hunt, because increasingly as they cut budgets, the government's ability to help us when we're in this kind of crisis is going to be diminished.
Right. Well, I'm glad that you brought up the annual editions. And first off, brilliant. That is so brilliant, not only for, you know, you as a writer to constantly be able to share your amazing wisdom, but also, you know, everything does change so quickly. The economy, yep. Technology, we all have to constantly be learning, you know, new skills. So that was a brilliant addition to the contract. And in terms of this edition, what specifically are some of the new tidbits in there that we can look forward to?
Well, I made several points that are key. The first is that in the best of times, economic times, there are always millions of people out of work looking for jobs. Just before this awful recession began in 2007 or 8 or whatever date you put on it, just before it began, there were 8 million people out of work in the U.S. So in the best of times, there are always millions of people out of work. The corollary to that is that in the worst of times, there are always millions of people that find jobs. I looked at a typical month during the height of the recession, which was April 2009, and 4 million people found jobs that month, supposedly at the height of the recession, and there were 3 million vacancies that didn't even get filled during that month. So there are always a lot of jobs available. But the problem is the government publishes this statistic the first Friday of each month, which tells people the relative change in the size of the working workforce. So they say, well, only 58,000 new jobs were created this month. That's not really true. What they mean is there is a net of 58,000 new jobs in the total size of the working workforce compared to 30 days earlier. What they don't talk about, except in a report that's published on an obscure website called JOLT, J-O-L-T, it means job openings and labor turnover, is that during the month there's a tremendous churn in the workforce, because with 137 million or more people in the working workforce, inevitably people retire, people get sick, people move and get out of the workforce or various things. So there are always this churn, which the layperson can think of as musical chairs. People get up out of those chairs, and while they're up out of those chairs, you can plop into the chair during the month. So, in fact, there are always millions of jobs that are being available and filled each month, and people don't understand that. So what I'm seeing as I do go around the country addressing various groups. I just spoke down at the annual convention of AARP in L.A. a couple of weeks ago. What I'm finding is less and less people are showing up for job-finding groups and that sort of thing because they're getting so despairing. Mm-hmm. They're just feeling like, well, it doesn't matter what I try to do. There are no jobs out there, and that's just not true. So I try to make that point as a key point in this edition.
Good. So it's not as bad as it seems.
Well, it's a tremendous social problem. Mm-hmm. You know, you have Occupy Wall Street, and we'll probably see worse demonstrations by far, larger demonstrations, more angry demonstrations, as the government more and more cuts services to the unemployed or ignores the problem of the jobless. But certainly for now, it's important to understand that there is a social problem with this country, that mm-hmm. there's never going to be enough jobs to fill the needs of all those that want it. That's why even in the best of times, there are millions of people out of work. That's a social problem. We have to conjure with what is that going to do to the social fabric of the country. But there's also the job hunters problem. And the job hunters problem is more simply stated. The job hunters problem is simply this. If 3 million or 4 million people found work this month, why weren't you among them?
Mm-hmm. Right. That's what I hear from most of my readers, is this question of, you know, how do I stand out from the masses?
Well,
there's many people looking.
Yeah. There's a further problem, however, and I highlight it in this year's edition, and it's new, and that is that it's long been known that job hunters and employers want to hunt for people in a different way. The employer's primary value is they want to hire with the least risk. If you put into a search engine on the internet cost of a bad hire, H-I-R-E, you'll be astonished at how costly it is if an employer hires somebody and then they don't work out and they have to start the search all over again. So employer's key value is I want to hire with the least risk possible. The job hunter's value is I want to cover the most territory with the least energy possible. So I don't want to have to work that hard at it. So the resume is the preferred instrument of the job hunter. Now, during good times, employers have trouble finding the talent that they need. So they will adapt their behavior to that of the job hunter. And the job hunter likes to send out resumes. Okay, the employer will read the resumes. The job hunter wants to have notice when vacancies occur. Okay, the employers will post notices of their vacancies, either on job boards like Career Builder or Monster, or on their own website. Then you have bad times appear, bad economic times appear. Now the employers don't have as much trouble finding talent, so they go back to their default position. They stop reading so many resumes. They stop posting most of their vacancies. They don't need to. But the hapless job hunter is not told, hey, if it's good times, employers cater to our whims and our preferences as to the way in which we want to go about the job hunt. But during bad times, the employer changes their behavior. Not every employer, but this is a generalization that applies to all too many. So the job hunter goes about the same behavior they did during good times, and what worked beautifully for them then suddenly doesn't work at all during these hard economic times. And the job hunter comes up with a theory, and the theory is the same for every job hunter. Well, there must be no jobs out there. That's not true. What is true is the job hunter needs to know that when there's tough times, they have to enter into the mind of the employer. They have to figure out what would an employer do at this time. And if it turns out to be, for example, well, they want to hire people with the least risk, that means either the employers are going to hire from within, or they're going to hire on the recommendation of some colleague of theirs whose word they trust. And if the colleague says, Charlie is a wonderful draftsperson, then the employer is going to say, oh, well, I'm looking for a draftsperson. I need to know their name, and how do I get a hold of them? We can enter, if we are unemployed ourselves, we can enter into that world of the employer and say, well, I'll look for a bridge person. I'll look for somebody who knows them and also knows me. This predisposes that, or pre-assumes, I should say, this assumes that you have chosen targets as a job hunter. You have chosen places where you would like to work. You don't pay any attention to whether or not they have a known vacancy, because vacancies can develop in a night and a day at a place. So you choose the places you'd like to work, and you approach them by finding somebody who is a bridge person, somebody that knows you, somebody that knows them. And fortunately, with the age of the Internet, what we have is this incredibly wonderful site called LinkedIn that millions of people know about, but millions more need to know about, because you can put in the name of the place that you're trying to target, and it will tell you who there is on that website, LinkedIn, who has worked there or is working there, and you can see if any of those names are people that you know, and then you can ask them to be your bridge person, and thus you give the employer what they most want, which is the guarantee of low risk if they decide to hire you.
Right. Well, there's two great points that I think you brought up there for my audience, and that is, you know, first off, really knowing what you want and targeting your search. I find a lot of people don't target the companies they want, and instead they're just looking for those existing openings and postings, and then also the focus on building your network. So those are really helpful pieces of advice right there.
Yeah, well, the sales of parachutes is up 20% this year. So I think the fact that I decided to revise it so dramatically for this year, people don't buy my book unless it turns out it works.
Right.
there are no advertising campaigns. The book has sold 10 million copies. And Time magazine this year gave it a great honor. It chose Parachute as one of the 100 best nonfiction books to appear in the last 88 years.
Wow.
That was the year that Time magazine was formed. So I'm cheerful that I've found some ways to really help job hunters. And the annual revision, which sometimes, of course, is a pain in the neck, and other times is a joy, that the revision this year has turned the book into a much more helpful book. I've been getting emails daily from people saying, boy, I love what you did with Parachute this year.
Wow. That is amazing to hear. And I'm so excited to have a copy of my very own. I have two questions.
You know, Chrissy, let me interrupt you.
Yeah.
I have spoken everywhere and on Sunday, places around the world and around the country, and I still have people coming up to me and saying, how do I find a copy of your book? And I say, try any bookstore in the world.
Right.
But it's so funny to me. I have a rich sense of humor. And it always strikes me as so ironic that it doesn't occur to them to go to their local bookstore. They probably think I'm selling it out of my home along with telephone books.
Yeah, the trunk of your car pops up and you've got books in there.
Yep.
Right. Well, I've had multiple editions over the years. I remember giving my older brother, 13 years older than I am, I sent him a copy several years ago when he was going through a career transition. It's a wonderful gift. It's one of those things that it's like you're giving someone the gift of empowerment. So, I mean, it's one of those things that will carry on for forever, really.
Well, thank you, Chrissy.
Yeah.
I had a rare experience. I was in one of Wolfgang Puck's restaurants down in L.A., and the woman at the cash register got so excited when she saw my signature on the credit card, and she said, "You know you're part of our family? My grandfather used your book. My father used your book. All of us children have used your book. You're part of the family tradition."
Wow. Oh, that must be so heartwarming.
Yeah.
I can only imagine.
Yes. Well, the good Lord has given me great grace, and I have the most superb health. I go to an acupuncturist, and she says, "You're the healthiest 80-year-old I've ever worked on in my entire life." I love that. I love that the Lord has given me such a long life, and I've been able to use it to help people.
Right.
And it's very rewarding to me.
Absolutely. I can imagine. I can imagine. And I am working with people who are going through career transitions myself. I know how rewarding it can be to give someone that little insight that just shifts everything for them and takes them to that next level in their life and in their career.
It's sometimes amazing how little it takes. One woman wrote me from Canada and said, "Your book changed my life." And I wrote back to her and I said, "I'm very curious, what in the book changed your life?" And she said, "Oh, that sentence on page 51 about you can do anything with your life you want to." I thought, that was earth-shaking right there.
Little nudge is all it takes.
Sometimes people want permission.
Right.
They want to think, "I am having this thought," they say to themselves, "and I wonder if this is a crazy thought." And then they read a book and they trust the author and they say to themselves, "Oh, look, it's right there on page 51. So my intuition about this was correct." So oftentimes what an author is doing is simply confirming the intuition that the readers already have about what to do with their life and how to go about doing that.
Right. That's actually a really great point, and it leads in nicely to this other question that I had about people who feel like they sense that they're not fulfilled. They sense that they're in the wrong career, but they just have no idea where to go next. If you had a person like this standing right in front of you and you could give them just one little snippet, what would that one thing be for them?
I would tell them that they need to have alternatives for every single thing they go about doing during the time they're out of work. First alternative would be simple. This is capable of being the best time of your life. You don't have to see this as just a period when you're tapping your foot, waiting for something to happen to you. This could be a time when you increase your command of wisdom, when you grow in your understanding of yourself, when you make a concerted effort to rethink where you want to go with your life. There are two alternative ways of looking at this period, and you need to hold on to both of them. Yes, it will be difficult. It will be a tough slog if you're out of work for quite some time. On the other hand, this can be a wonderful time in your life. Secondly, when they go about job hunting, they need to have alternative ways of going about the job hunt. There are 18 of them, as I list in my book, and they have to have more than one. If they only just send out resumes, they did a survey and they found if 100 job hunters are only using one strategy for their job hunt, 51 out of those 100 give up by the second month. Granted, they have to come back later, but momentarily they just abandon the job hunt because they only had one way to go about looking for work, and that way didn't pan out.
Mm-hmm.
So they did a survey of people who used two or more methods of job hunting, and they discovered that only 33 out of each 100 gave up by the second month. It made a vast difference if they had alternatives, and that applies to everything, targeting small companies and not just large ones, going after people that you want to work for, not just waiting for them to have vacancies. If you have alternatives for each part along the way, you keep hope alive in you. And hope is so crucial, particularly in these days when the news coming out of Washington day by day is so discouraging.
Mm-hmm. Right. I appreciate what you're saying about, you know, keeping your perspective in check when you're out of work. It's really so easy for people to get incredibly anxious and scared, and they come from a place of fear rather than that place of hope.
Yep.
And that has such a huge impact on what happens for them.
It sure does. Their attitude plays a large part. If mm-hmm. I'm talking to somebody, I have done live workshops for years and years. Now, Capella University is going to put out an online version of my workshops by the middle of November. So I'm not going to be doing live workshops for a while. I'm going to be writing a lot. But I've been doing live workshops for years and years and years, and I can always tell when I have that person standing in front of me which ones are going to be successful and which ones aren't. It's all in the attitude. The ones mm-hmm. that are going to be successful say, maybe I haven't been doing this the way that's most effective. I've got to reexamine my ways.
Right.
The ones that I know are going to have trouble are the people that say, well, I know how to do this, and I'm not going to try to read a book, and I'm not going to try to learn anything about job hunting because I know I'm valuable and somebody's going to come after me. And they have an attitude that dooms them to being out of work far, far longer than they need to be.
Right, right. I also find that there's a lot of people right now who, when they're going to that next move, they are so afraid of it being the wrong move.
Mm-hmm.
And I always try to remind people that, you know, you can do all of this front end work, and there's still always a certain amount of risk, right? It's kind of impossible to get rid of that risk, you know?
I tell people that what you find at first is likely to be only a part of the vision you have in your head about what you want to do with your life. It's likely to be only a 40 to maybe 60% overlap. But that means you have to start with the largest vision of what you really, really, really want to do with your life, so that if you only get 60% of that, you've gotten far, far more than if you start with a vision you've hacked down in the name of supposed reality, and you start looking. I remember a boss of mine lost his job, and he said he was going to go for a job interview one time. He was on the East Coast. I live on the West. So I called him up after the interview, and he sounded so happy that he'd been turned down. And I thought to myself, what's going on here? Why is he so happy he got turned down? Well, it turned out that job was only a little tiny part of what he really wanted to find, and he hadn't defined a large enough vision and dream for himself of what a dream job would be. And that, so when people have the attitude, I'm going to look for my dream job, I may only get part of it, at least initially, but at least it'll be a part of something wonderful. They get the dynamic and the energy they need for the long haul during their job hunt in this tough economic time that we live in currently.
That's great. That's great. And I love that, you know, concept of always, you know, aiming for, it's kind of like, you know, you shoot for the moon, and then even if you miss, you're among the stars, something like that, that you at least have a piece of the biggest vision for yourself.
Yeah.
Great.
Aren't you going to ask me how the title of the book got made?
Well, you tell me. I would love to know. Please share.
It was a joke. I was at this meeting long before I ever thought of writing the book, and they said, Dick, you're sitting near the blackboard. You put up what we have to talk about during the meeting. And the first thing was the next date for the meeting. So I put up next date. And they said, somebody's got to go visit Pocatello, Idaho, because we have some trouble there and we got to smooth it out. So I wrote Pocatello on the blackboard. They said, and we have to talk about these guys who have to bail out. And I went to the board and I wrote, what color is your parachute? just off the top of my head, they all laughed so hard that later, when I wrote the book about 2 years later, and I self-published it, I had the freedom to put whatever title I wanted on it. And I remembered that title that made people laugh. So, of course, I slapped that title on the book because I didn't have to sell the book. I didn't have to put a marketable title on it. When a publisher initially approached me sometime later, they said, "We want to call this the job book." I thought, am I glad that I didn't listen to them. People will write me and say, "I want your book. What is it called? Sky Blue, Sky Shoot?" Something like that. But it strikes people as such a ridiculous title. They get a smile on their face and laugh when they hear the title. But it's
right.
a metaphor that I just put in as a joke.
Well, it's funny. I think that for me, it's become such a part of, almost a part of my vocabulary. It's like, for some reason, I actually did not think of that as a question, because it's like, it's a part of the lexicon. What color
is
your parachute?
Yes.
Is
it
the...
It has become that.
Yeah.
Back in 1999, Dan Pink, now a very famous author, he wrote an article about me for Fast Company magazine, and he said, "This phrase has become a currency. What color is your parachute?" I know people often approach me and say, "What's yours, yellow?" And I say, "Yeah, I'm a coward."
Nice. It is fun. It does put a smile on your face. And thank you for sharing. I like knowing the history behind it now. That's great. And thank you for just taking your time to share all of this with us today. I know that my readers are just going to love hearing from you. If they want to perhaps access some of your online workshops that you're going to be working on, connect with you?
Yeah, the online workshops, I have my own website. It's called jobhuntersbible.com. It's all lowercase, no apostrophe or space, just jobhuntersbible.com. And there I will be posting a notice as we get closer to the release date. I'll be posting a notice of exactly how they can find out the information about it and choose to enroll if they want to.
Great, great. I'm sure lots of them will go there. You're a wonderful person to just be connected with. So thank you so much for taking your time with us today.
Not at all, Chrissy.
And, I feel like I learned a lot from you, so I appreciate
<Uh-oh>.
It.
Beware. Those that do can, those that can't teach.
Oh, no, don't say that. It's a mission.
I have a firm sense of how God has given me talents, and I measure my sensitivity to other people by how much I become also aware of their talents. So, because I have a firm feeling about my valuableness and as well as everybody else's around me, I love to kid myself. I love to make jokes about how old I am and stuff because it just strikes me as amusing. The human creature sometimes is so amusing in its behavior that I burst out laughing sometimes when I watch my own antics, and I say to I have the most wonderful wife in the world, and she's from the Philippine Islands. And I often say to her, "You know, I wonder if I'm an idiot savant. Maybe I know everything about job hunting and career changing, but I need to be guided to even be able to walk up the stairs. Any other area of my life, I seem to be an idiot."
Well, I think that kind of humor keeps you real, it keeps you down to earth, and it helps people feel connected to you, too. I mean, this thing that you've created is really huge, and it touches so many people in so many ways. It would probably be pretty easy for someone to disconnect and become a little, little arrogant or ego-driven in that situation, and it doesn't sound like that's happened to you. So that's wonderful.
Chrissy, I think it depends on your parents.
Mm.
I had the most wonderful parents, and my father was editor for the Associated Press. I come from a newspaper family, actually. I'm the only person that didn't go into the journalism. And grandfather, father, and brother. And my father used to say, he had these contemptuous phrases for people that started to think they were better than anybody else. And he'd say, well, he's begun to believe his own press clippings.
Yep.
Or
yep,
he'd say,
I've heard that.
Well, he's got to go out and buy a larger hat, doesn't he? So you get a lot of your attitudes in life from your parents, and I was very, very blessed that I had such wonderful parents.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's really wonderful. Well, thank you so much once again for sharing all of this with us, and congratulations on all of your wonderful success, and congratulations on the 40th edition. That's huge.
Thank you, Chrissy. I hope it helps the readers.
It absolutely will. Take care. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.